I want to welcome you all in the balcony as well as in the auditorium and here below. I want to welcome you on behalf of the Left Forum that produces, the whole board, excuse me, of the Left Forum that produces this event each year. And I want to tell you, as you might imagine, how proud and happy we are to welcome Michael Moore here with us this evening. So I want to be very brief in my introduction, but I wanted to welcome you to Michael Moore and Michael Moore to you, and he will come out in a moment. But first, a few words by way of brief introduction. Michael Moore has had a significant influence on our country by shaping in important ways how millions of Americans see what is going on in a new and importantly different way. And I want to celebrate that, but I want to do it by trying, at least in a small way, to imitate his use of humor as I go about it. So I propose a contrast between the influence Michael Moore has wielded in and on our country and beyond with the, I want to contrast it, with the influence coming from other places. And I want to pick in particular Rush Limbaugh, Rick Santorum, and others. So let me begin very briefly. Those folks appeal, they're not the only ones, obviously, but those folks appeal to an American population threatened by an economic crisis that is worse than anything anyone has experienced except the very oldest amongst us in terms of the Great Depression. They're frightened by the future that spreads out in front of them. They're worried about changing cultural norms, often stimulated by that economic crisis. They're upset. And in a way, Rush and Rick and the others appeal to them. And they invite them in their upset and their anger and their despair to turn against and to hate immigrants, people who aren't white, those who don't share the same fundamentalist religious commitments, and most recently, as we've seen, women. And in the process, they divide, they produce tensions, they deepen divisions, which at a time of economic difficulty are very serious threats to our culture. So let me do the contrast. What did Michael do? I'm just going to refer to Roger and Me briefly and Sicko and Capitalism, a Love Story. He too is speaking to those same Americans, or trying to. But what he does is try in those films, as in many of his writings and the stories that he tells, to teach what's going on, to do it with a compassion, not with a desire to set people against each other, but to share with them a common experience, a common sense of feelings, and a common sense of what's wrong. He teaches about a system that doesn't work anymore. And that is a completely different way to respond to the crisis in this society. And even before we learned the terms 1% versus 99%, what he was trying to do was to respond to the crisis by unifying the 99%, not by setting them against one another with false claims of who's to be the scapegoat for capitalism's breakdown this time. Michael Moore can be properly arrayed among those about whom it is said he speaks truth to power. But because Michael has a remarkable sense of humor, he also knows that there's always a risk for those who speak truth to power. And that risk is it leaves us with the truth and them with the power. And so in his films and his writings, if you pay attention, you'll see the undertone of someone who understands that the problem is the power and the need to confront that power, and even more profoundly, to face up to the fact that that power is sustained by a particular economic system, which is the same system that that power serves. The decision he made to call his last film by that name, Capitalism, was the first time that a major cultural artifact was able to present to the American people in a way they could both understand and criticize the name of the system that had been taboo to speak. And by doing that, he opened a space that the Occupy movement has now opened much wider, so that finally we can deal with a system that we should have been debating for the last half century, that we feared to as a nation, and that Michael Moore deserves an enormous amount of credit and applause for having opened that up in this country for the betterment of the political future we all are going to have to live with. It is a genuine honor for me to let you know that he is the author of this, his most recent book, called Here Comes Trouble, a remarkable testimony about his own life. But the biggest honor for me is to be able, on behalf of the Left Forum, to present you this evening with Mr. Michael Moore.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Left. Wow, that's a very kind introduction. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Are you going to sit out here the whole time, or because you go get us a couple? I was just saying backstage that I started out on the subway down here, and I forgot what day this was, even though I had put on green earlier. Somewhere in the middle of the day, I forgot. And, you know, this is the one day in New York City where there are just too many white people on the subway. And it was very scary. And after one stop, I had to get off. I just thought my only protection is that I look like most of them, you know. So I just try to get into that. Oh, I hope nobody recognizes me. Oh man. Somebody was also just saying to me back there that. That poor guy who made that Coney documentary that was arrested yesterday, you know, he just ran naked through the streets, babbling and just crazy ass. And I thought, God, if you just waited one day, that would have been considered socially acceptable behavior. One day. Oh man. Well, happy St. Patrick's Day. And all four of my grandparents are of Irish descent, and they all had a story to tell about their parents and grandparents coming to this country. And those stories were very important for my sisters and I to hear as we were growing up. I also want to say a happy birthday. This is the six-month birthday of Occupy Wall Street. And... For 6 months, we've been bringing greetings to the Muppets on Wall Street. Oh, you have to, yeah, there was an op-ed in the Times this week. Yeah. Well, anyways, I have to tell you, though, I have never seen a political or a social movement catch fire this fast than this one. And, you know, I'm in my 50s, so I've lived through enough of them and knew about those that came before me. And what's so incredible about this movement is that people have, it was, I, really, it wasn't, it, hadn't, it hasn't taken 6 months. It really just took a few weeks before they started to take polls of people, of Americans. And they found that the majority of Americans supported the principles of the Occupy movement. This was back in October. And and then they took another poll, and it said 72% of the American public believes taxes should be raised on the rich. 72%. I mean, I don't think there was ever a poll that showed a majority in favor of raising taxes on the rich, because up until recently, the vast majority of our fellow Americans believed in the Horatio Alger theory that anyone in America can make it. It's an even and level playing field. And now they, the majority at least, vast majority, know that that's a lie. They know that there's no truth to that whatsoever. They know that the game is rigged, and they know that they don't have the same wherewithal on that playing field that the wealthy have. So for this to happen, just within weeks, I was just, I when I finished the film he referred to, my last film, at the end of the film, I'm down on Wall Street wrapping a crime scene tape around the New York Stock Exchange. And then, you know, I've been making these films now for 22, 23 years, starting with crashing into the world headquarters of General Motors in the first film, and continuing on through a whole host of the Fortune 500 in my other work, but basically I'm at the point, you know, this is like 09. Where I'm burned out, and I'm kind of tired of doing this. So I just said at the end of the film, I'm not going to do this anymore by myself. There's a few of us, you know, that we're always, it's the same people we see at the same things every year or whatever. So America, when you decide you want to rise up, I'll be right there with you. And I thought I had a good decade or two before I would see this happen. And it just has the most amazing power, the effect that it's had on people. I mean, think about other political or social movements. I mean, what other movement has had the majority of the people with them after 6 weeks? There was a poll in September for the first time, majority of Americans, about 54%. Said they believe that gay marriage should be the law of the land. It was the first time that a majority agreed with that statement. When was Stonewall? 69? 42 years? 42 years from the rebellion that began to getting a majority of the American public to stop their bigotry against people who are not heterosexual. I mean, that took a long time. The Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King, 6 weeks after the Montgomery bus boycott, he did not have the majority of his fellow Americans with him on this. 6 weeks after the Gulf of Tonkin, we did not have the majority of Americans opposed to the Vietnam War. 6 weeks after, pick any of a number of moments in the women's movement, did we get a majority of Americans? We couldn't even get a majority to say that they would support an equal rights amendment that just had one sentence in it that just said, we're equal. That's it. Couldn't do that. And this movement, in 6 weeks, has a majority of our fellow Americans with us. We all know, those of us who've been active in these groups for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, do I hear 60? 60 years. Do I got 70? 70! We all know that the hardest part of being politically active is not pulling together the buses to go down to the demonstration in D.C. It's not the weekly meetings. It's not the signs. It's not, having all of this, all the work that in the past has gone into these things. For what reason? Because we wanted to convince a majority of our fellow Americans that this was the right way to go. That's the hardest part, right? You remember how hard it was to convince Americans to be against the Vietnam War, or how hard it was for them to support women's rights, or on and on and on. And what I am so happy with, and what we are blessed with Occupy Wall Street, is that the hardest part of the job is done. So think about this. We don't have to struggle for years to convince the American public that these banks are out to ruin their lives. We don't have to work for years to convince our fellow Americans that the health insurance companies put profit ahead of their own health. We don't have to do any of that anymore, do we? You live in the real world, right? You know this at work, at school, in the neighborhood, at church, at temple. You know this, right? This is where people are at. They're already there. They are with us. So we should just go, wow, this the biggest job. And I have so many slacker tendencies. This is what I really like. I just like the fact that the toughest part of the job is over. So now that we have tens of millions of our fellow Americans agreeing with us that the rich are up to no good, that these corporations have sold them out, have sent their jobs someplace else to exploit people around the world, made them cut back on their health care, on their vacation days, on their sick days, made them work longer hours for less pay. Somebody asked me a while ago, how did this Occupy Wall Street start? Who organized this? They tried to look for the one person that organized it. There is no one person. I said, if anybody organized it, I'll tell you where to go. Go talk to Goldman Sachs. They organized it. They organized this movement. Go talk to Cigna Health Insurance. Go talk to BP. Go talk to, right? Just go down the list. They did the bulk of the work for us. They opened the eyes and took the scales off those eyes of our fellow Americans who woke up finally to realize that their best interests were not at the hearts of those in charge. So that's where our fellow Americans are at. That's where the majority of our fellow Americans are at. So what are we going to do with this now? Because we're not used to this. We're not used to, after just a few weeks, being handed an army of millions of people who want to see change take place in this country, who want their lives back, or a life at all, never had the chance to have that life. I mean, we should really, there should be a dance after this speech tonight. Wish we should dance our way over to Zuccotti Park. But of course, the scary part for us, because we're always on the losing side, right? We're always in the minority. We don't have to be reminded of all the times when you've seen those polls and you've been in that 20% that opposed the Iraq War. Once the Iraq War started, it was a 50-50 thing before the war. But once the war started, if you remember, right, only 20%. Bush had an approval rating of over 70%. That's the America we lived in. Anybody remember how that felt? 10 years ago, 9 years ago? Not good, right? And I remember sitting there watching those 27 Democrats in the U.S. Senate vote for this war. Chuck Schumer, Hillary. I won't go down the whole list because I can see where the response most of them are going to get. But it wasn't just them. It was the editor of the New Yorker magazine, David Remnick. It was Bill Keller, who was then a columnist for the New York Times. In fact, it was the New York Times itself that helped bring us to war with their front page stories lying about the weapons of mass destruction on the front page week after week. I could make the case that they were more responsible for the Iraq War than George W. Bush. Because I expected that from Bush. But from the paper that perceives itself as the voice of liberal America, to run those stories and to let Bush say, see, the New York Times says it so. See, Nick Kristof is even, he's kind of saying, maybe, yeah, you know. Right, do you remember that? Yeah. Al Franken supported the war. No, I hate to, you know, bring up the past, but I'm just trying to, in case you've forgotten how lonely it is to be on the left in this country, to be for peace, to be for all these things that I went through here, these women's rights and gay rights and ending racism in this country, ending the prison industrial complex in this country. It has seemed through most of our lives that we were never going to live to see the day when things would get better. Even the optimists amongst us, and I consider myself one of those. I'm not really a cynic. I have a real strong belief that people are good at their core, and they just get messed up somewhere along the way. But that I do believe that a majority of people in the end will want to do the right thing, if presented with all the information, if not kept in the dark. And of course, we know that's how fear works. You can make a country afraid by keeping them ignorant and stupid. And that has been the equation. People don't know what's going on, and so then they become afraid. And what does fear lead to? It leads to hate. And what does hate lead to? It leads to violence or wars. Why are we such a warlike people? I don't think Americans, we don't really see, you know, it's never really discussed that way, is it? I remember I read it was an essay by D.H. Lawrence that he wrote back in the early part of the 20th century, and he said, you know, the Americans, when you think of the Americans, they're just something, he said something to the effect of they're a great bunch of killers. That's the story history will record. History will not be kind to this era. And so I thought that this era would just continue on for the rest of my life. And I would keep going to things like this and keep, you know, I'll go back to making the movies and I'll write books and I'll do these things and I'll put my part into this as best I can. But all knowing that the good days are someplace way off in the distance. I no longer feel that way. I feel that time is now. And I think that it is so important for us who don't have much experience leading a majority to very quickly learn how to do it. Because we have the majority of Americans with us. Now, they're not always necessarily going to stay with us. But because of the lousy education system, because of the control of the media and the little information that does get out to people, they can be easily manipulated back into a different place. So how long will we have here before we say to our fellow Americans, the majority, let's go. Let's go get this. We can do this. We're a democracy. You see, they know that the corporate chieftains, the people on Wall Street here, are the real power. They know that now. They know that what's left of our democracy is a thread or two. Those threads are the United States Constitution. There's that problem with that piece of paper that still exists that does give us the right to go into a booth and close the curtain and elect somebody, anybody, to stop this. Now, we're never hopeful about that, right? Let's talk about being on the losing end of things and having to settle for Democrats over and over and over again to the point where it just, you know, the kink in your neck is just, oh! But for right now, the people are with us. So I'd like to talk a little bit tonight about what we should do with that. I'd like to just throw my ideas out there. You know, the great thing about Occupy Wall Street is that it's open to anybody's ideas. This is a horizontal organization. It's not a vertical thing. Whenever they who's the spokesperson here? And everybody raises their hand. You know, because everybody has a story to tell. Everyone has been affected by this disparity of wealth in this country. So everyone is a spokesperson. Everyone is the leader of Occupy Wall Street. If you're living in Boise, Idaho, and you want to start Occupy Boise, just do it. You don't have to write into national headquarters here for permission, and then we'll take 10% of the dues that you collect. There's no grants you have to write. You just have to exercise your constitutional rights as a citizen of this country. And we, those of us here, at least in New York, in Occupy Wall Street, we want you to do this. We don't want to be in charge of Occupy Boise. You know what Boise needs, and you need to occupy it. That's why there are occupies now in over 1,000 towns and cities in this country. It's amazing. I've been to small towns in Michigan. I remember in the early weeks, I went to a place called Niles, Michigan. I went to Grass Valley, California. Yeah, where is Grass Valley, right? It's up near Nevada City. And there were like 400 people there at a demonstration at Occupy Grass Valley. I mean, I just saw this throughout the fall. Everywhere I went, there were all these Occupies. And it was clear that nobody was going to wait for permission to do it. People knew this was the moment to seize. And people seized the moment. This is incredible that this has happened. And it continues on through the winter in different ways. People have had teach-ins. Students have occupied college boardrooms. Our nurses have continued demonstrating and fighting for healthcare rights for all of us. I mean, it continues on. And Wall Street has become afraid of us. I mean, this is... No one's ever been afraid of us. They see us coming down the street with our all yellow Workers World banners, all the same signs from the RCP. Here we come. They see us coming, and they're like never afraid, right? It's been embarrassing. Laughing at us every time for the last 30 years. They're not laughing anymore. They're afraid. They have the CEOs of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, they've been canceling things right and left because they do not want to be out in public making an appearance. They cannot go out in public to make an appearance. And why can't they do that? Because we're nonviolent people. Why? You can leave the house anytime you want, Jamie Dimon. Lloyd Blankfein, you can leave anytime you want and go. It's a free country, and we are nonviolent people, so what are you afraid of? They're not afraid, actually, of us in this room, the left forum. They're not afraid of us. They're afraid of those tens of millions of Americans that they have screwed over the last decades. That's who they're really afraid of. And who would know better than Lloyd Blankfein or Jamie Dimon. How many people have been hurt by their mortgage fraud, by how they invested teachers' pension funds? You know, actually, when I went down there on that, to film that scene, to put the crime scene tape around the stock exchange, clearly I couldn't get a permit to do that. And there's all those barricades and this, you know what it's like across the way here. And so but I decided I'm going to do it anyways. And, of course, the police show up. And this cop is coming toward me, and I'm going, oh, geez, I don't want to get arrested here. I got to finish this. And so I see him coming, and he's about maybe 10, 20 feet from me, and I said, officer, this is just a piece of comedy, and it'll be over shortly. I'll clean it all up. Don't worry. And he comes up to me, and he says, don't worry, Mike. You take it all the time you want. He said, he said, these bastards in here have lost millions of dollars of our pension funds. That's who they're afraid of. What if the cops and the firefighters and the nurses and the teachers and the auto workers and the steel workers and the person who's bumping out your car and putting some Bondo on it, what if they actually decided to become politically involved? What would happen then? They're so afraid this is going to happen because they know what I said at the beginning of this, that the American public is already convinced that we're right and Wall Street is wrong. They already know this. Yes, Wisconsin is going to be the first, I hope, wonderful example of how the people are going to respond in another month or two. So if you don't mind, I would like to just throw out a few ideas here, a few tactical ideas and a few strategy ideas. But as I said, I wrote this piece in The Nation this week, if you get a chance to read it, and it's called The Purpose of Occupy Wall Street is to Occupy Wall Street. And let's never forget that. And I said, you know, this movement, by and large, is being the fuel of this is coming from young people, young adults. And and it's really, those of you who've been involved in Occupy Wall Street who are my age or older, it's been just the most amazing thing to watch. And it's been very important for us to not have them do it our old way, because I kind of like their new way. It's a little messy. It maybe seems a little goofy sometimes, you know, but there's real heart there, isn't there? And while, you know, this just, it amazes me that the young people these days are not mad at us, that our kids are not mad at us for the world that we've handed them. Because back in the 60s and 70s, we were determined that we were going to make the world a better place. And the world we would hand the next generation would be a better world. That was our commitment. That's what we worked for. And we've ended up handing them a worse world where they're going to be worse off than we are. Amen. You should be mad. Who here went to City University in New York or any of the states? What did you pay in tuition, sir? Free, $56? Are you hearing this, kids? Yes. My generation, though, and those older than me, allowed a situation to take place where we were going to make sure that you were indentured servants the day you graduated from college, that you would become wage slaves because you'd be 20 years in debt, not able to get out of it, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 in debt. By the time you pay the interest over 20 or 30 years, it's another $50,000 or $100,000. And so you can't maybe necessarily go work the job you want to work or quit when you don't want to be there anymore. You can't quit because you got to pay your college loan next month. You should be mad, young adults, that we, the baby boomers, the 60s generation, we allowed this to occur. But they're not really mad at us. You know, and I got to, you know, it's really kind of sweet because if you remember how we were with our parents, I mean, we were very different, right? I mean, we turned the thing. You know, you know the life your mothers and grandmothers had. We made it a little bit better. We turned it around, but we didn't turn it all the way around. Here's what we did do, I think that's right, as far as these young people in here are concerned. We decided that racism had to end, and sexism had to end, and homophobia had to end. And if you spend any time at the Occupies around with any of these young people, one of the most encouraging things to see is the kind hearts that they have. The level of racism in the younger generation is almost non-existent. Sexism, almost non-existent. Homophobia? I know, Mike, you're in New York. You're just saying this in New York. If we were in Alabama, you couldn't say that. I will say, without a doubt, whether it's Alabama or New York City, that this younger generation has done a better job with these issues than we have. And they're already trying to see to it that this world is a less racist, less sexist, less homophobic place to live in. And that's very encouraging. And it's very encouraging, too, to see young people at the Occupy, at the General Assemblies, wanting to give everybody a chance to have their say. It's like the opposite of our old way, where the left would just spend most of its time fighting each other. And they don't want to do that. They don't want to fight each other. In fact, they want to do the opposite. They want to just let everybody do whatever.
Staten Island, my friend, is different.
Staten Island. No, I'm going to guess, actually, that if I went to Occupy Stapleton, that I would see young people who are less racist and less sexist and less homophobic than their parents and grandparents' generation. Well, that's the other thing with us. We're such pessimists. Mike, don't come out here and tell us everything's good. Oh, no, it's horrible. That's how I get up in the morning, because the world sucks. What's Michael Moore saying? He's saying the revolution might actually happen. He's saying it is happening. Whoa. What are we going to do? Well, here's a few things. In this, it's from Michigan State. All right. I lost my place now. Oh, right. Okay. In this movement, and for this movement to grow, we need to use our sense of humor. We need to employ satire and humor on a level that the left has not been used to for many, many years. I will submit to you that I believe, and I can say through my own personal experience, that humor is a great vehicle for your political message. It's a welcoming vehicle. It's why Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are so popular, because they're able to impart information by using a sense of humor. And this is so important in this movement. And I think we need to go to the yes men. And I think they should be a very important part of this movement. Because I want to see the yes men do their thing. They've actually started a thing called Occupy the Boardroom. And I have a feeling that means they're going to be doing something. I don't know what it is. But I think that has such a powerful way to drive these points home to people that are not on the official left. And I really want to encourage that. I had a TV show, it was called TV Nation back in the 90s, and on our Christmas show, we decided to take some carolers, Christmas carolers, to the homes of the CEOs of the tobacco companies. And but the carolers were all people who'd lost their voice boxes from due to smoking. And so there we are outside the home of the head of R.J. Reynolds, and there's like 30 or 40 people going, "We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas." I'm confident that those who saw that show the next day at work were talking about big tobacco in a whole different way. Please use your sense of humor. If you don't have one, get one. If you don't want to get one, then do some quiet work someplace to help the movement. But let this thing rock. Because the people are already with us. We need to demonstrate differently. I don't ever want to get on another bus in Chinatown and head down to Washington, D.C. That's it. I'm officially resigning from that. The way that these young people, the new ways that they've come up with to demonstrate, I love them. Have you seen it? Have you seen the silent treatment protest? Have you seen this? At UC Davis, after the cops pepper sprayed those kids, and then a couple days later, they lined the sidewalk that the chancellor was going to have to walk out of to her car, and they lined it with a few hundred people, and as she walked out, they said nothing. They just stared at her. Complete silence. And she had to walk this walk of shame through them. Their silence was louder than anything. A couple of weeks ago, women's groups in Virginia did the same thing when the governor there proposed that women go through a transvaginal probe. If they had decided that they were going to have an abortion, they would have to have this probe. And so to protest this, the women organized, again, hundreds of people. They surrounded the Capitol building and the steps, and all the legislators going in had to walk through. You could have heard a pin drop. It was so quiet. And the quietness of it was deafening. And it looked like these politicians were doing a perp walk. I'm sorry we don't have video here to show you this, but I go online and watch this. It's so cool. We need to come up with things like that, different ways to demonstrate, to make our point. I think that's very powerful. The use of social media. This I don't need to really go into, right? Everyone gets this now, right? People with no color in your hair, or those with no hair, there aren't any holdouts still, are there? Please don't hold out. This is one of the most incredible inventions in the history of mankind, and we can use it. For the greater good, and I encourage people to do that. If you don't have a Facebook account, think about getting one. You don't have to tell everything you did at the mall today. What you had for breakfast and lunch. You don't have to do that. You can just use it with your other politically aware and active friends, and you can share articles you run across. You can put these links up, and you can educate people with this. You can encourage people to do this. Two other ideas on this, and then I want to give you some strategy ideas. Two more of the tactics. I think that it's very hard for average Americans to protest these days because of the time it takes. So many of our fellow Americans are having to work two jobs to get by. They work one on the books, one off the books. Or their health problems have gotten so bad because they haven't had the money to get their teeth fixed. And if you don't fix your teeth, you then eventually can't chew food very well. And when you can't chew food very well, you have to eat a lot of Wonder Bread and simple carbohydrates because that's all the mouth can handle. And when you eat that, then you have all the health problems that go with that. And you're so focused on your health and trying to get better and trying to get somebody to help you because you can't find the right help and you certainly can't afford it. And you're fighting the insurance company call after call, day after day, to try to get them to cover this procedure. And these, of course, are the very people that would love to be with us, but can't, because just getting through the day is a struggle. So that's why I want to say to you that for every American who's in that position, we need to go and get somebody who isn't to join us in this movement, to be the stand-in for that person who can't be there because of the suffering that they're going through. We should make that a commitment. Don't do meetings. Keep the meetings to a minimum. This movement needs action. I think our past movements, we've had way too many meetings. Does everybody agree with this? It's like, I do not want to go to another meeting. I love the General Assembly idea, and I think that, you know, there's things there that could make it even better probably, but the idea of thinking that you're actually being politically active by going to a meeting isn't really true. You're politically active when you actually take an action against those in power or for those who have a solution to help us out of the mess we're in. That's political action, not a meeting. And then finally, I was on this panel with Naomi Klein here back in the fall, who is, I think, a hero. And she said, I think it's also important that we're all kind to each other. That we make sure that in the infancy of this movement, that we take this sort of this pledge, really, amongst ourselves, to be kind and generous to each other. And to understand that each of us, all of us, everybody, has something they're going through. And if they're not going through it, their spouse is going through it, or their kids are going through it, their parents are going through it, their neighbors are going, somebody that they're deeply attached to is going through something really bad. And we need to make a commitment to not have the typical infighting that goes on. But to be kind to each other, to hear everyone out, and then do what the majority feels like we should do, but respect the minority and make sure they always have a voice, because they'll be there to keep the majority honest. So I just wanted to second what she said. Okay, so. Now, if I were like, if this were like an army, a real army, and I was a general, I'd have my pointer, and I'd have, here's how we're going to do this. No more, we're not going to talk up here, we're going to talk, this is the reality, there's where they're at, here's where we're going, here's how we're doing it. So just kind of imagine the imaginary pointer, and Wall Street, and corporate America, and everybody else up there on the screen. I get stopped a lot by people on the street, people when I'm traveling. Again, these are not political people. And they say to me, what can I do? I really want to get involved in this. What can I do? And they always say, too, that they really can't sleep overnight in a park. And I said, well, that's okay. You don't have to sleep overnight in the park. There are many things we can do. And I think it's very important that this movement make people aware of the fact that there are many avenues into this movement where they can join it and be part of it. That staying overnight in encampments is not the only way. But thank God for those encampments. Thank God for the anarchists who started this on September 17th. Thank God. I'm telling you, this movement probably wouldn't have got the traction it had if that first group of people hadn't decided to go right into the face of power in that first week and not give up. Because at first they were ignored. Nobody covered them on the news, on the national news at all. And then when they started to, into the first week, it was basically, oh, look at these, you know, hippies with their tambourines and their drums. But by the end of the first week, when a march took place over by Union Square, and the New York City police, in the form of one individual, decided to pepper spray four women who were already penned in by the police, and pepper sprayed them in the eyes. That image went out across the country, went out in a viral way, as they say, and people saw that, and they felt one thing. They were being pepper sprayed in the eyes. That's what they felt. And there was a catharsis. It was a catharsis. And the following Saturday, when even more people decided to show up and decided to go onto the Brooklyn Bridge, and the New York City police made the huge tactical mistake of arresting over 700 people. I've never heard of an arrest that large in New York City. It was just amazing. Ray Kelly yesterday was complaining about how they've spent $17 million on police overtime dealing with Occupy Wall Street. And I said, I hope it's $170 million this year. And you should make the people on Wall Street who you're protecting pay for it. Because actually, you don't really have to protect them, you know, because we are a nonviolent people. We're not going to harm anyone in the Goldman Sachs building. So why all the cops? And to the undercover New York City cops who are in here tonight, I just want to... I just want to say thank you for coming. I know you're missing the Louisville game on the NCAA tournament. All your buddies are all getting smashed right now on St. Patrick's Day, and you're stuck in here with us. So, we welcome you. You are the working class. Don't be tools for the people that want to hurt you. Join us. Come be with us. Actually, I think the cop was the guy yelling from Staten Island over there. I'm just kidding. Just kidding. That's what I mean. More humor. So, let me just throw these things out here. Number one, I think it's very important that we occupy Wall Street. I think it's important that Zuccotti Park keep going. If we can't stay there overnight, where did I see this yesterday? Was it in Memphis or Occupy, where they said no tents could be in the park? So all the demonstrators showed up wearing a tent? Where was that at? And the cops didn't know what to do because they were clothes. They weren't really tents, but they were tents. And that's the kind of jujitsu that we can do with them because they just don't know where we're coming from. Who's the leader? Who's the spokesperson? So we need not only for Zuccotti Park to continue, because that I have to tell you, I mean, I live most of the time I'm in Michigan, and Zuccotti Park is known by people all across the country. It is the Holy Grail. It is the epicenter to people who don't live here. You know, you probably didn't even know there was a Zuccotti Park before before Occupy. I didn't. I'd never heard of it. But trust me, people out there have heard of it. And I think it's very important. I mean, you know, those of us who were down there a lot in the fall, after just a month or two, those big red, Big Apple tourist buses, they put us on the stop. It's like a group of senior citizens from Omaha. It's like they all get their cameras out and they're going like this. We have to keep this going. And I think one of the best mornings I saw was that day that we decided to really get on Wall Street early in the morning and try to delay the opening of the stock exchange. I don't know if anybody was there. There were hundreds of people there. And it really was, it really did look like we were actually in the Army because we had all these different routes in. And when one did block, we'd radio over to the other, and everybody'd shift over to that. No, there's no cops over here. Come on, we can go through here. I mean, it was exciting, and it was interesting to see how scared the stock exchange was that they weren't going to be able to open on time, and it was critical to them that they never miss a minute of their dirty work. And so, but I said this in the nation. I want to say this here: we need daily and weekly nonviolent assaults on Wall Street. Nonstop. Nonstop. And this does not have to be just with people who live in the New York area. We're going to run out of people. They can only arrest us so many times. We're going to run out. But I swear to God, there are thousands, tens of thousands all over America who would drive here if they got penciled in. The same way that when you're in Flint, Michigan, and you want to get tickets to David Letterman, and so you know, I'm going to go to New York in February, and I write in, and then I get the tickets in the mail, and there's two tickets to Letterman for February 24th. And we can do the same thing. You know, we can set up, because now we have the internet, we can set up, you can actually, in Boise or Omaha, schedule your day that you're going to assault Wall Street, nonviolently. And we can already help the police, because we're very transparent. We'll have all the names right there. You can just, they can just write the tickets out in advance. People, because, okay, there's the people coming February 24th. We've got Bob from Boise, George from Omaha. No, but I really believe this would happen. And it certainly would start with the people who live just a few hours' drive from here. They would certainly do this. We should really think about organizing this because it's important for us to be visible. And it's important for the American public in the way that they have been trained with the visual medium. And it's very easy for those in power to create out of sight, out of mind. We must not leave their sight. And that's why Zuccotti Park has to continue, and we have to have these daily demonstrations of trying to get through those barriers to get to the stock exchange. Because all we want to do is politely ask them to stop. other things in terms of direct action that I think we need to do, and some of them are already happening. The Occupy Our Homes movement is incredible. Some of the people who started this movement, I had in my film there 3 years ago. They were Take Back the Land. We followed them in the Miami area and put them in the movie. And then Marcy Kaptur, the congresswoman from Ohio, who in the film just told people, don't leave your homes. Do not let them evict you. Do not leave your home. They can't find the mortgage. They can't find the paperwork. Go to court and tell the judge to make them show you the mortgage. They can't show you the mortgage because they cut it up 1,000 ways, bundled it, and shipped it off to be sold in China or Switzerland or someplace. They can't. And so the whole Occupy Our Homes movement. But I think this needs to. I think we need to grow this, because what I would like to do. This is, and I will do this as a citizen. I want to be able to sign up in my neighborhood in Michigan to say that if anyone in our village where I live. If we hear of anyone being evicted by a bank, I commit to show up and stand in the doorway. And in every town, just imagine every town across America especially Benton Harbor. Imagine every town across America having a mod squad of people who will come at a moment's notice and risk being arrested to stand there to prevent that family from being tossed out on the curb. You have what do you call this unit? Okay, shorten it a little. Eviction strike force. I didn't know. I just said Grass Valley. I didn't know anybody was here from Grass Valley. That gives me such hope. Thank you for being here. The students have to continue occupying their schools and universities. The sit-ins, stopping the business of the Board of Regents or trustees, doing whatever we can to support these students, and really, people of my age, we've. Like I said earlier, we've done them wrong by allowing this system to come up to such a disgusting place that it's now the number one cause of debt in this country, student loans. So students, do this, and we, your parents, will back you, and we'll be there for you. We need to occupy our healthcare system. In the same way that we have these strike forces in our communities to show up when someone's being evicted, when someone is denied a treatment or a procedure or surgery because their health insurance company said they weren't covered or they don't have health insurance, we have to stand up for them. We have to go to that hospital and demand that they receive this treatment. If you live near one of the regional headquarters or main headquarters of the health insurance companies, we need to walk into their lobbies and occupy them. We need them to stop this. We need to occupy our jobs. There are many examples taking place right now where workers are just refusing to allow these things to continue. We need to encourage people to sign union cards. And be represented in the workplace. And like what happened at the glass factory in Chicago, when they tried to move the company someplace else, don't let them. Sit down. Bolt the doors. You can't leave. You can't leave glass company because my tax dollars gave the Bank of America, which is funding you, that's my money. So first you take the bailout from me, and now you throw me out of a job with that money. Are you fucking crazy? And my last idea here for direct action in civil disobedience is that we need to occupy peace. We somewhere in the discussion, I think we often forget to talk about the wars we are currently fighting. And we're fighting wars in 7 or 8 countries right now, not just Iraq and Afghanistan. We've got our troops in many places around the world that are doing things, sometimes covertly, sometimes in the shadowy parts of what we would consider legal behavior in this country. And the $2 to $4 billion a week that we spend on these wars, we've been doing this now for over 10 years. Just imagine those 10 years at $2 to $4 billion a week. 10 times 52 weeks, 520 weeks, times, $2 to $4 billion. How many schools could that have helped? How many people could that have covered with health problems? We can't ignore this aspect of it, of how the military-industrial complex still runs large parts of this country. So that's number one, direct action and civil disobedience. Number two, we need to provide for people so they can do individual actions. And this is for a lot of people who are not necessarily political people. When they say to you, well, what can I do? What can I do to be part of Occupy Wall Street? And I always say to them, well, you're part of Occupy Wall Street just by saying you're part of Occupy Wall Street. At the moment you say, I am Occupy Wall Street, you are Occupy Wall Street. That's it. You are now in the movement. I said, here's something you can do. Make a sign and put it in your window or out on your lawn that says, we are the 99%. Imagine in the suburbs across America turning into a subdivision with street after street filled with these yard signs saying, we are the 99%. The politicians, the banks, et cetera, they wouldn't, no matter where they turned, if it was they were in a city, you'd look up at an apartment building and you'd see this in the windows. We are the 99%, or we support the 99%. It's a very simple thing to do, is to make that, put it on your cars, put it in your home, put it on the lawn. But the lawn, just imagine the visual of looking down a street and seeing sign after sign after sign after sign after sign, we are the 99%, we are the 99%, we are the 99%. Or looking at an apartment building and seeing that. That's a very simple thing that we can get started and get people to do. It's something every American can do. We can encourage them to do what some have already done, move their money out of these banks and put it in a credit union or a locally owned bank. And I think people need to be able to feel free to occupy their block. You could just, if you live on Oak Street, you could start an Occupy Oak Street. Just go and knock on the doors of your neighbors, ask them who'd like to get involved in this. And if they say, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to start by putting signs up saying we are the 99%. Whoa, okay. What's the next thing we're going to do? Well, we're going to go and take our money and put it in the credit union. Oh, okay, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. What else can we do? So those are some ideas that people can do as individuals, and I think we need to create more of that so that people on an individual basis who are not able to go to demonstrations or sleep overnight in the park, there are things that any American can do, no matter what their station in life is, and I think we need to really get behind that. The final and third area is the area we don't really want to talk about a whole lot because it has a lot of stinky poo around it. And that's electoral politics. But there are those among us in the United States of America who do believe that electoral politics will do some good. And we need to honor that and respect that and create a place for them within this movement so that they can take the principles of Occupy Wall Street and try to find candidates to run for office who believe in these things. Or what they could be doing this year is do what I did in Flint with the guy who's running for Congress there. I asked him to take a pledge that his top priority in Congress will be to remove the money from politics, take all the money out. And I think in every congressional district should be asking the people running for Congress, will you do this? Will you commit to doing this? And then when they get elected, hold their feet to the fire so that they do it. I think that there's some of us that also need to push past the sort of the the kind of visceral reaction I think a lot of us have toward politicians and electing politicians and thinking that they're going to be the be-all and end-all for us, because we know that's not true now, right? I mean, we've lived through enough of this. We know from just the last election of who our president is that he didn't turn out to be everything that we wanted him to be. And so people get disillusioned when that happens, because they put all their eggs in that election basket. And then the politician doesn't come through, and then it's like, why did I bother? First of all, I want to live, so. But I think that there are people in this room, right now, tonight, who should seriously think about running for office. I'm serious. And it doesn't have to be for Congress. It doesn't even have to be for state legislature, Senate. It doesn't have to be for mayor or city council. It can be for precinct delegate. It can be for the school board. If more of us got involved and were willing to give some time to do this, if the right people were running, you know, I mean, as cynical as we are about politicians, do you know this about yourself? That if you were on the ballot this fall and we, the rest of us in this room, elected you for Congress, are you going to turn on us? No. Are you going to take money from Wall Street and the banks and do their bidding for them? I mean, seriously, who in this room would do that? I don't think most of you would you? Who in here can be bought? You're an honest man. It's good if we know that up front. In fact, I might even vote for the politician, the first politician that says that. I can be bought. I just want everyone to know. Some of you need to think about running for office, or people you know should run for office. Why do we leave it up to the lowest common denominator to run? You know, I mean, the people that run now for office, I mean, it's just got, those of you who've lived long like I have, do you agree that the gene pool of politicians has been depleted? It's beyond the incestuous part of depleting a gene pool. It's sort of like, you know, when you have a Xerox, a copy, and you make a copy of a copy, and then you make a copy of a copy of a copy, and then a copy of a copy of a copy, and then by the time you got the 10th copy, what does it look like? That's what we've got now in the state houses and in Congress. And we can stop that by running for office ourselves. And no matter how much they can put into these elections with all their money, what they can't do is when we go in that voting booth, they can't put their hand on our hand and pull the lever or punch the card or draw an X. They can't do that. We really do hold the power, and you know what? That's got to scare the shit out of them. That there are more of us than there are of them. And what if we actually ever decided to realize that and exercise our power? Where would they be then? I think, you know, don't think they're just sitting there at the country club or up in their penthouse apartment enjoying this. They're not enjoying it. They're really worried that if we figure out how to organize the tens of millions who support us, can you imagine the dreams they have? You know, as dark as we see the world, as unhopeful as we are about the future of this planet, trust me, their dreams are real nightmares these days. And that's a good thing. So we need to not ignore electoral politics. We need to be involved in it, and we need these two constitutional amendments that are being proposed now. We need our mass organization that we have around the country that's going to build to get behind these constitutional amendments. Number one, corporations are not people. And And number two, we need an amendment that has all the electoral reforms that we need. Taking money out of politics, moving election day to the weekend so more people can vote, making voter registration easy for people, preferential voting systems. I mean, there's a whole bunch of great, and let's go back to a paper ballot, please. So direct action, individual action, and electoral politics. And the final thing that I want to say tonight is in your introduction here, when you mentioned the word, capitalism and me using, when we were thinking about the title for the film, there was a lot of talk that we shouldn't put the word capitalism in there because it's, first of all, it's not used. Do you remember? It just was never used. And if you used it, it was code. You were marginalized. And I said, no, I think this is what we do. We have to, actually the original title of the film was Crapitalism. Don't try and buy the domain names tonight. I already bought them all out. But I thought, I think we should just, let's just do this. We can't be afraid of this word. We've got to say this word and we've got to call this out for what it is. This is an evil system. This is an evil system that is set up for the benefit of the few at the expense of the many. It's set up so that I get tired when I go on these talk shows they say, what's the solution? I say, well, number one, capitalism has to go. They're like, whoa, you mean crony capitalism, Mike. No, I don't think you need to put an adjective to it or a repeat yourself by saying crony and capitalism. The sort of liberal media establishment, they want to hang on to this old Adam Smith idea of capitalism. They think that can come back magically someday, right? Where if everybody just puts in a hard day's work and you get paid for that and you can do better in life and I say to them, well, yeah, but that's not what capitalism is. You can't define capitalism. You have to define a word by the way it is enacted and used now. You don't define marriage as a man has to ask permission of the woman's father to marry her, and then when married, the woman has no property rights and cannot divorce her husband. That is not how you would define marriage, is it? Well, of course not. Well, I hate to tell you, 100 years ago, that's what the word marriage meant. And then it changed. And capitalism may have meant something else, and it might have been a kinder, gentler version of it somewhere back there. But those days are long, long gone. Whatever kind of imagery you have of this pie-in-the-sky thing, the Horatio Alger, everybody's got a chance, it was bullshit then, but it's really bullshit now. And so I want us, in the long run, through this movement, to develop an economic system that will ensure that everyone has the means for food, for housing, for a job, for health, for transportation, for education, for a vacation, and where every American can truly feel that they can run for office because they don't have to have a dime in the bank to do so. I want someday for this country to say that the Earth's resources don't belong to a corporation, they belong to everyone. I want it to be a crime for anyone to make a profit off someone who is ill. I want education to be our top priority because a democracy cannot survive with an uneducated and illiterate public. I don't think anybody should have to work more than 4 days a week. I'm just trying to make us look better for the history books. You know, when they call us wage slaves, I want us to gradually get to the point where more than 50% of our time is really for us and our families. And the other stuff, yeah, we have to do because, you know, these lights have to go on and we got to sweep the floor and we got to do these things. But I think that I want to see the concept of a business be something that the workers own. That where we have, there are so many, I put a couple examples in my film of cooperatives. This is such a great idea. Or even do it just as a nonprofit. You know, I've gave a speech a while ago about how the newspapers can survive in America. It didn't get around very much because there were newspaper people in the room. But I said, you know, the thing here is that I think people like to read a newspaper, and I think they like to hold a newspaper. And if the internet is killing the newspapers, why are the newspapers still alive in Europe? Because I think they got the internet there last year sometime. So how is it that in Sweden today, they sold enough daily newspapers today to cover every man, woman, and child in Sweden? You know, how is it that that happens in France? How is it that there's 13 dailies in London? How does that happen over there? And it happens in part because their business model is different than ours. Their business model is the circulation comes first as a source of revenue. Advertising is second. In America, advertising is number one. Circulation is second. So we say right from the get-go, you, the readers, are secondary to the advertisers. And so every decision gets filtered through that. What is best for us to make money from this paper? You know, the Guardian in London, the Frankfurt Morning Paper, these are nonprofits. So one of them is owned by a trust. These are all, I mean, newspapers in Europe are trying this model, and it works because they, again, think that the important thing in disseminating information is not to make a profit, but educate people about what's going on in the world. And everybody who works there can make a nice salary. You don't have to, you know, wear sackcloth and ashes here, but you can function as a co-op or a worker-owned or a nonprofit, and everybody there can do well. And what would be the harm in that? Wouldn't we solve a lot of our problems if we were just wired to think this way about work and business? Well, those are some, I mean, I have a ton of other ideas. I think the voting age should be lowered to 16. If that frightens you, don't worry. The 16-year-olds that don't give a damn about anything, they're not going to go vote anyways. But there's a lot of smart 16 and 17-year-olds. And if they're going to be in wars in a couple of years, I think they should, leading up to that, have a say as to whether or not those wars are going to be going on. Austria has lowered the voting age to 16. Brazil has lowered it to 16. A number of countries now are lowering it to 16. You probably haven't read about it, that's what's... it's a little idea, but it'll speak volumes to our teenagers about how much we value them and their input in the discourse. So, in closing, I just want to thank you for letting me speak here tonight to throw out some of my ideas on what we need to do. I really want to encourage you to not let this moment slip by. Our ship has really come in. The spotlight is on Occupy Wall Street. And so, yeah. And I think this is our invitation to head over to Zuccotti Park. It's a 10 minute walk. 5 minutes if you're young. Huh? All right, so go ahead, start the banner. And again, thank you everybody for coming here tonight. Let's not lose the moment. The moment is ours and our fellow Americans. Thank you. Occupy Wall Street.